Okay, ready to dive into a case that's got more twists and turns than a legal thriller.
Oh, I'm always up for a good legal puzzle.
Yeah, this one might just test your legal knowledge. We're tackling County of Oneida v. Oneida Indian Nation. It went all the way to the Supreme Court back in 1985, and it had a huge EE impact on land rights and tribal sovereignty.
Yeah, Oneida, that one's a classic. It really gets to the heart of some really complex questions about historical injustice.
It does. It really makes you think. Like, imagine owning land for centuries, building on it, living on it,
Yeah.
only to find out, oops, the sale was never legal to begin with.
Oof, yeah, that's a tough situation to be in. Talk about a legal nightmare.
And to make things even more complicated, we're talking about a land deal that happened way back in 1795.
Wow, 1795, that's going way back.
So let's get into it.
Yeah.
What exactly happened in 1970 when the Oneida Indian Nation filed their lawsuit? Set the stage for us.
Okay, so in 1970, the Oneida Indian Nation, they sued two New York counties over land that had been sold to the state in 1795. Their argument was that this sale, it violated a federal law, the Non-Intercourse Act.
Non-intercourse act.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm vaguely familiar. But just for our listeners who might not be legal scholars, can you give us a quick breakdown of what that law is all about?
Sure. So the Non-Intercourse Act basically says you can't buy land from a Native American tribe without the federal government signing off on it, giving their approval. It's like a safeguard, you know.
To prevent shady land grabs, I imagine.
Exactly. It was meant to protect tribal lands from being taken without, you know, without proper oversight. It's a really important part of federal Indian law.
Okay, that makes sense. But here's where I'm getting a little stuck. If the land was supposedly sold in 1795, wouldn't any legal claim be, well, wouldn't it be way past the statute of limitations? We're talking almost 200 years later.
That's a really good point. And that's where the Oneidas' legal strategy gets really interesting. So they didn't try to claim all 100,000 acres outright. Instead, they got clever.
Oh, I love some legal maneuvering. Tell me more.
They focused their lawsuit on just 2 years' worth of unpaid fair rental value, specifically from 1968 to 1969.
So they kind of sidestepped that whole statute of limitations issue by narrowing their focus.
Precisely. By framing their claim this way, they brought it within the existing statute of limitations. It was brilliant, really.
Yeah, sometimes it's not just about the law itself, but how you use it.
Express.
That's fascinating. I can already see why this case is considered such a landmark decision. But before we get too deep into Oneida the Second, which is what we're really here to discuss,
Right.
you mentioned something earlier about the case going to the Supreme Court not once, but twice. Is there more to the story? Did I miss something?
You're right. There is a bit of a prequel. The case we're focusing on is often called Oneida the Second because it was actually the second time the issue went before the Supreme Court.
Oneida High. Okay, now I'm really intrigued. Give me the backstory. What happened in that first showdown?
So Oneida First, which took place in 1974, was all about a really fundamental question. The court had to decide, could tribes even sue under federal common law for claims like this? Could they go to federal court and say, hey, this old land deal, it violates federal law?
Ah, so it's about establishing whether they even had a legal standing to bring these kinds of claims.
Exactly. And the Supreme Court's answer was a big, resounding yes.
Wow, so Oneida, I was like laying the groundwork saying, okay, tribes, you have the right to be here. You bring these cases to federal court. And then Oneida the Second took it a step further and really dug into the specifics of this land dispute.
You got it. Oneida the Second delved into the nitty-gritty, tackling all sorts of complex questions about the validity of that 1795 land sale. They even got into things like latches.
Lashes. That sounds like a legal term I might need a refresher on. What exactly is lashes?
Basically, it's the idea that you can't just wait forever to bring a legal claim. At some point, it becomes unfair to the other party, right? Like, imagine if someone borrowed money from you and you waited 30 years to ask for it back.
Yeah, it wouldn't really be fair to spring that on them out of the blue after all that time.
Exactly. So the court in Oneida the Second had to decide if this concept of latches applied to this very unique situation. And then there's the 11th Amendment.
Oh, the 11th Amendment.
The counties tried to argue that if they lost the case, the state of New York should be the one to pay up.
Trying to pass the buck, huh?
Well, they said it was about the 11th Amendment and states' rights.
This is getting pretty complex. I'm already sensing a few legal rabbit holes we could tumble down here.
Oh, absolutely. This case is full of them.
But before we get too lost in the weeds, can you give us a quick roadmap? What were the core issues that the Supreme Court had to grapple with in Oneida the Second? Break it down for us.
Okay, so one of the big ones was, Could tribes actually use federal common law to bring claims about land deals that happened centuries ago? That was a huge question. And of course, there is that whole issue of justiciability.
Justiciability. Now there's another one. What does that even mean?
It's basically a fancy way of asking, is this something a court can even decide? Sometimes issues come up that are better handled by, say, Congress instead of the judicial system. So they had to determine, is this land dispute something a court can legitimately weigh in on?
I see. So they were figuring out if the court even had the authority to rule on this centuries-old land deal. And on top of that, they had to consider the county's argument about New York State footing the bill, plus that whole Lickis thing about the time that had passed.
You got it. Those were some of the key questions on the table.
Wow, so many legal layers to unpack.
Oh, yeah. This case is like an onion. It's got so many layers.
So tell me, what did the court ultimately decide? Were they swayed by the Oneidas arguments, or did they side with the counties and the state? Give us the big reveal.
Well, that's where things get really interesting, and that's a story for part two of our deep dive.
Ooh, a cliffhanger. I guess our listeners will have to stay tuned to find out what happened next.
They will, and trust me, it's worth the wait. This case takes some surprising twists and turns you won't want to miss. All right, so remember how we left things hanging with the Supreme Court facing some pretty tough questions about the Oneida Nation's land claim?
Oh yeah, it was like a legal cliffhanger. What did the court end up saying? Did they side with the Oneidas?
They did, and it was a big win for the Oneidas. The court basically said that 1795 land sale was totally invalid right from the start because remember the Non-Intercourse Act?
Right. They needed the feds to approve it.
Exactly. And they didn't have that approval, so the sale was a no-go, according to the court.
So essentially, New York never really had a right to the land in the first place.
That's what the court found. It was a huge EE victory for the Oneida Nation and really established their claim that original sale was, well, illegal. And it also set a precedent that the Non-Intercourse Act isn't the only way to address these types of disputes. The courts could step in too, using federal common law.
Okay, so that's a win for the Oneidas and for tribal sovereignty in general. But there's this whole doctrine of discovery thing I've heard about. Wasn't that used to justify taking land from Native Americans in the past? How does that fit into all of this?
Yes, the doctrine of discovery. It's pretty controversial, right? It's this old legal principle that European powers use to justify claiming land that was already inhabited by indigenous peoples.
Yeah, it's not exactly a highlight of legal history.
Definitely not. But here's where it gets interesting. In Oneida II, the court actually kind of flipped the script on the doctrine of discovery. They basically used it to support tribal rights.
Wait, really? How they do that?
They emphasized that, yes, the discovering nation, like in this case, England, way back when they might technically hold the title to the land,
Okay.
but the tribe still keeps their right to actually occupy and use the land unless, and this is key, unless Congress specifically takes that right away.
So they're saying there's a difference between holding the title and actually having the right to, like, be on the land and use it. That's a pretty interesting legal distinction.
It is. It all gets into that really unique relationship between the U.S. government and tribes, this trust relationship, and the idea that treaties should be interpreted in a way that benefits the tribes.
Okay, so it's not just about the strict letter of the law, but also about this historical and political context. But, and I know I keep bringing this up, but what about the fact that it took almost 200 years for the Oneida Nation to bring this claim? Did the court just ignore that huge gap in time?
No, they didn't ignore it. In fact, that's one of the most interesting aspects of the case. One of the justices, Justice Stevens, he actually wrote a dissenting opinion, where he disagreed with the majority decision.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that.
He argued that waiting so long to bring the claim was fundamentally unfair. Generations of people had been relying on New York's ownership of that land.
I can see his point. It does seem a little messy to just undo all of that history after so long. How did the majority of the justices address that?
Well, they basically said, look, laches is that legal term for delaying a claim. It's not just about how many years have passed. It's also about fairness. And they said the Oneida Nation didn't act unreasonably in waiting to make their claim.
Okay, but 200 years. What made it fair in this specific case?
The justices pointed to the fact that Congress had actually started showing more and more support for tribal land claims, starting in the 50s and up through the 70s when the Oneidas filed suit. They saw that shift in the political climate as evidence that the Oneidas weren't being unreasonable.
So the political winds sort of shifted in their favor, and that actually helped their legal case. Interesting how all of that plays together.
It is. It shows you that legal arguments often happen within this bigger social and political context that plays a role in how the law is interpreted and applied.
Definitely. So it's one for the Oneidas on the latches issue.
Yeah.
But what about that argument from the counties that if they lost, New York State should have to pay up? What happened with that whole 11th Amendment thing?
Yeah, the 11th Amendment. That one's a bit tricky. In that part of the case, the court sided with New York State. They said, based on the 11th Amendment, the counties couldn't force the state to reimburse them.
Wait, why not? If the state was the one who bought the land back in 1795, wouldn't they be the ones ultimately on the hook for it?
It gets into the weeds of the 11th Amendment. That amendment basically set some limits on when you can sue a state in federal court.
So it's kind of like a get-out-of-jail-free card for states in certain situations.
In the specific situation, yeah, you could see it that way. But not everyone on the court agreed with that decision.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Justice Brennan, he wrote a concurring opinion, where he agreed with the overall outcome but had a different take on this part. He actually argued that the 11th Amendment shouldn't protect states from being sued by their own citizens, like the counties in this case.
Interesting. So even the Supreme Court justices had different opinions on how the law should be applied. It really makes you think about the role of interpretation and, well, maybe even personal philosophies.
Absolutely. It just goes to show that even established legal principles are open to different interpretations and applications depending on the specific facts of the case and the judges involved.
Definitely. So we've covered a lot of ground here, but just to bring it back to the big picture, remind us why this Oneida II decision was such a landmark case. Why should our listeners care about a land deal that happened centuries ago?
It's a great question, and it comes down to a few key things. First, Oneida II was a huge victory for tribal sovereignty. It really affirmed the ability of tribes to go to court and seek justice for historical land dispossession. It also sent a clear message that state laws don't automatically trump federal common law when it comes to these types of disputes.
Okay, so a major win for tribal rights and a reminder that federal law has some serious weight in these cases.
Exactly. And for those of us who work in this area of the law, lawyers and legal scholars, Oneida II was huge. It highlighted just how powerful federal common law can be in tribal litigation. It's a reminder that states can't always hide behind sovereign immunity.
I see. So big implications for tribal rights, for the relationship between states and the federal government, and for how these cases are handled in court.
Precisely. Oneida II really was a watershed moment in the development of federal Indian law.
But this case didn't answer all the questions, right? There must be some loose ends still out there.
You're absolutely right. It left some pretty significant questions unanswered. Like, how do you even start calculating damages for centuries of displacement? What exactly should the role of latches be in these cases? These are things courts are still grappling with today.
It sounds like the legacy of Oneida II will continue to unfold for years to come. It's not just a historical footnote.
It's not. This case is a powerful reminder that historical injustices don't just fade away. Balancing tribal rights with, the interests of modern landowners who may have been relying on those old land deals, it's an incredibly complex process, and it's something we're still working through.
It's so much more than just a legal puzzle.
It is. Oneida II forces us to look at these long-standing issues and grapple with how to achieve justice in a way that recognizes the past, but also paves a path forward.
Well said. Before we wrap up this part of our deep dive into Oneida II, I have one more question. If that 1985 decision said the original sale was invalid, does that mean the Oneida Nation actually got their land back?
That's where things get even more interesting, and it's a story for the final chapter of our Oneida journey.
Ooh, another cliffhanger. Our listeners will have to wait till next time to find out what happened next. Okay, we're back and ready to wrap up our Oneida saga. I'm on the edge of my seat. What happened after that 1985 ruling? Did the United Nation get their land back?
Well, it's not quite that simple. The story doesn't end there.
Of course not. It's law. Nothing is ever simple.
Exactly. Oneida II was a turning point, but it was really just the beginning of a much longer process. And the impact of those decisions, both Oneida and Oneida II, it goes way beyond just that one tribe's land claim.
So how did these rulings change the game for other Native American nations? Give us the big picture.
They really did shake things up. Oneida II, it basically gave tribes this powerful new tool to use in their legal battles, federal common law. Remember how we talked about that earlier?
Yeah, that was a big part of the Oneida II decision. But remind us why it's such a game changer.
Before Oneida II, It wasn't really clear if tribes could use federal common law to fight for their land rights, especially for claims going back centuries. But after that 1985 ruling, the Supreme Court said yes, federal common law applies in these cases, and those state statutes of limitations, well, they don't really hold the same weight.
So it was a major win for tribal sovereignty and their right to seek justice for historical wrongs.
Exactly. It basically opened the floodgates for other tribes to start filing their own land claims. Claims that had been sitting there for, well, sometimes for generations.
So Oneida II really did trigger a wave of litigation across the country.
It did. And not every tribe was as successful as the Oneidas were, but all of those cases put pressure on states and on the federal government to start taking tribal land rights a lot more seriously.
I bet. No state wants to end up on the losing side of one of those lawsuits.
Right. It made states think twice about just ignoring tribal claims. And we saw a lot more settlements happening outside of court, land buybacks, even the return of some lands to tribes.
So it wasn't just about winning in court. It was about using those legal victories as leverage to negotiate better outcomes.
You got it. Oneida II became this really powerful bargaining chip for tribes. They could go to the negotiating table and say, look, we've got this strong legal precedent now. Let's work together to find a solution that works for everyone.
I love that. So it really did shift the power dynamics between tribes, states, and the feds.
Absolutely. It was a turning point for Indian country. Tribes had more legal and political clout to push for their rights and reclaim their heritage.
That's amazing. Okay, so we've talked about the legal and political side of things, but did these Oneida cases have any broader impact on society? Did it change how Americans thought about Native American land rights?
That's a really interesting question. It's harder to measure, you know, compared to something like the number of lawsuits filed. But I do think those cases, along with other land claims brought by tribes, helped to raise awareness about the injustices that Native Americans had faced.
Yeah, you can't really ignore a story like that, especially when it's playing out at the highest court in the land.
Right. Suddenly, people were being confronted with these uncomfortable truths about broken treaties, forced removals, the way indigenous people had been systematically dispossessed of their lands.
And I imagine that led to some important conversations about how to right those wrongs, maybe even achieve some kind of reconciliation.
You're exactly right. These cases became part of this larger movement for Native American rights. They forced policymakers to think differently about land claims, about economic development for tribes, about tribal self-determination. It really did spark a shift in thinking.
So it was more than just a legal victory. It had these ripple effects throughout society and culture.
Exactly. Think of it like this. Oneida was a pebble tossed into a pond, and those ripples, they spread out in every direction, changing legal precedent, raising public awareness, even influencing government policy.
Powerful imagery. It really shows how one legal case can have such profound and sometimes unexpected consequences.
It does, and it reminds us that law is never static. It's always evolving in response to what's happening in society and politics, in our understanding of history.
It's all interconnected, isn't it? And in the case of Oneida, those connections led to some major changes for Native American rights and really for the fabric of American law and society.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Oneida is a testament to the power of the law to challenge historical injustice, to shift the balance of power, and ultimately to move us toward a more just and equitable future.
That's a powerful message to end on. Thank you so much for taking us on this deep dive into Oneida. It's been truly eye-opening.
My pleasure. It's been great exploring this case with you. And remember, everyone, history isn't just something in the past. It's alive and well in the courtrooms today, shaping the world around us.
Absolutely. Well, that's all the time we have for this deep dive, but we'll be back soon with another fascinating legal case to unpack. Until then, keep those legal minds sharp. And remember, justice, like history, is always in the making.
See you next time.